One light year is the number of miles a light beam travels in 1 year. That's approximately 5.88 trillion miles. And the closest star beyond our sun is 4.24 light years away, or nearly 25 trillion miles. How do we know that? This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and you're listening to the After Dinner Scholar, Wyoming Catholic College's weekly podcast about the great books and the liberal arts. A recent news article announced the discovery of 300,000 new galaxies, bringing the number of galaxies in our universe to somewhere around 100 billion, and some of them are 12 to 18 billion light years away. I won't do the math here, but suffice it to say that the numbers boggle the mind, as does the notion that we can actually calculate such distances. Yet starting back in 240 BC in Alexandria, Egypt, people began calculating the circumference of the Earth. And once they had figured that out, well, it was only a matter of time before people started calculating the distance to the moon, to the sun, and finally to the stars. How did they do it? I asked Dr. Scott Olson, who's been teaching these things to our Wyoming Catholic sophomores, to begin by explaining how the Egyptians calculated the size of the Earth, and to go on from there.
What Eratosthenes realized was that there was a well in a town called Syene, where on the summer solstice, you could look down the well and you would see that the sun was directly overhead. So he lived in Alexandria, and he went to a well on the summer solstice and he looked down a well and he saw that the sun was not directly overhead. There was some angle, so that you could put a stick in the ground and see a shadow. You wouldn't see the sun directly above the stick. Now, the sun's far enough away that you can sort of imagine all of the rays of light coming from the sun as parallel lines. And so to really see this, what I would suggest, I guess, our listeners would do is get out a piece of paper and try to draw the Earth and put a point for its center and draw some rays of light coming in straight down into the well in Syene. Syene's about 5,000, well, he said 5,000 stadia. That was the unit of measurement being used at the time.
And it's right on the Tropic of Capricorn?
It's right on the Tropic of Cancer.
Cancer.
Yeah, exactly, yes. Which means that on the summer solstice, when the sun is in the most northern part of the sky as it ever is, it happens to be directly overhead at noon. Exactly. Yeah, if you draw this, you can reason that if you put a stick in the ground in Alexandria, you'll see a shadow, which you can measure. Imagine your stick is a straight line coming from the center of the Earth. And using that shadow, you can figure out what the angle is, the angle between your stick and the ray of light that's coming from the sun, which is parallel to the ray of light that's going into the well at Syene. You can figure out what that angle is, and he estimated to be about 1/50th of a complete circle. So 1/50th, we would say, of 360 degrees. And that's the same angle that if you draw this, you can see that's the same angle that's inside the Earth.
Well, inside the Earth from the well to Alexandria.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And you can so it's a little geometry problem. You can see it's not too hard to work that out. So that angle, that means that 1/50th of a circle is how much you've gone around the Earth when you've traveled from Syene to Alexandria. So if that's 5,000 stadia, then it'll take 50 times 5,000 stadia to go all the way around the Earth, which is about 250,000 stadia, right? And that works out to about, we think, 40,000 kilometers, which is pretty close to our current estimate of the circumference of the Earth, at least the polar circumference of the Earth. Mm-hmm. So,
and they knew that the Earth had a circumference, that is, that it was a ball.
Yes, that was known to everyone, really. I mean, Aristotle talks about this. He made several great arguments that the Earth was spherical and that the moon was spherical. Some of them are things like, if you watch a ship sail away, you can see it descend below the horizon. He also knew that if you went to more southern latitudes, you could see different constellations. And you can also see that during an eclipse, the Earth's shadow on the moon appears to be always a kind of curvy shape that you'd expect if the Earth was spherical, but not otherwise.
Now, it was the solstices and eclipses that led to other discoveries about the size and distances. Tell us about sort of the history of how people were figuring this out.
Yeah, it's not at all obvious, right, how you would, for example, measure the size of the moon, right, or measure the size of the sun. On the one hand, we live in a privileged position now where we know a lot of these things, or at least we have access to a lot of this information through, say, Wikipedia or Google. But that's also a problem because it makes it harder for us to realize that the questions are not obvious or the answers are not obvious. It's not obvious that the moon is really big or that the sun is really big. It's easy to imagine that the sun is maybe not that big of a thing. It's a really bright thing, and maybe it's not even that far away. Maybe if you threw a baseball really hard, you could hit it. So it required quite a bit of ingenuity and determination to try to actually to reason through how you would estimate the size of this, say the moon or the distance to the moon. And one thing that Aristarchus realized, who was living around the same time, the size of the moon could be estimated from the amount of time it took for the moon to go through the Earth's shadow during a lunar eclipse. Sorry, the distance to the moon could be estimated in that way. So, in other words, you can say to yourself, well, if it takes the moon about 27 days for it to complete an orbit around the Earth, that is to say, to return to the same place in this, you know, against the starry background, but it also takes about 3 hours for it to completely pass through the shadow of the Earth during a lunar eclipse. And you can imagine that the shadow of the Earth during a lunar eclipse is about 2 Earth radii. It's not exactly that, because the shadow kind of spreads out a little bit, but you can sort of say it's about 2 Earth radii. And you can work out from that, well, if it's going with the same speed around its entire orbit in 27 days, but it's also going through the Earth's shadow in 3 hours, you can use that to figure out, in terms of Earth radii, how big the diameter of its orbit is. Which is pretty, once you've drawn this, you can see that if you think about it sort of algebraically and geometrically, it's not a very difficult problem. But for to have worked that out at the time was really remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about other things that are even further away? We've got planets and stars and galaxies. How did we start calculating those distances and sizes?
Right. Well, so the first thing we do, this is also connected to the story really with Aristarchus, we use something called parallax. So parallax is just the fact that it's what we call the fact that when you change your vantage point, things that are closer to you or farther away from you seem to move different amounts. So one example is if you're driving in a car and you see the trees racing by you, but the mountain in the distance seems to barely be moving at all. One way to see this is if you hold up your hands, take something in the room you're sitting in, maybe a clock on the wall or something, and put your thumb over it with closing one eye, right? And then switch the eye that's open, you'll see that your thumb seems to jump around, but the thing that's farther away seems to hardly move at all. If you do that again, actually, do it again where you hold out both hands. So put your right hand some distance away from your face, put your left hand twice the distance away from your face, right? Both of them covering up the object on the wall. And then change your eyes again. And what you'll see is that the thumb that's closer to your eye will seem to move farther than the thumb that's farther away from your eye as you switch eyes. The same kind of thing is happening with astronomical objects. The Earth is moving around the sun, right? We're about 150 million kilometers away from the sun. And so in half a year, we move from one side of the sun to the other. And because our vantage point is changing, we ought to see nearby stars move a lot, or at least more distant stars. In fact, they barely move at all. They move so little that it took us you know, 2,000 years or so looking for them to actually notice it happens. And so this is one of the reasons why Aristarchus, he, amongst other things, we talked about him estimating the size of the moon and the distance to the moon. He also estimated the size of the sun. He realized it was much bigger than the Earth. He actually speculated that the Earth traveled around the sun rather than the sun traveling around the Earth, because he saw that the sun was so much bigger than the Earth. But he wasn't, he didn't get a lot of traction with that idea, in part because if it were true that the Earth were moving a lot, we ought to be looking at nearby stars from different vantage points, and so we ought to see them move in space. And we don't seem to see that, or at least we didn't think we were seeing that for a long time. It wasn't until the late 1800s that we were first able to observe that little shift, that parallax. The problem is that the change in position is minuscule. It's typically much smaller than the width of a blurry star. You know, when we see a star, it's basically a point of light coming through our atmosphere, but it gets distorted and blurred a little bit, so it has some thickness, some width. And typically the movement that's caused by this change in vantage point, this parallax, is actually much less than the width of the blurry star. So detecting it is just an amazing achievement of engineering and ingenuity. It's incredible.
And then things are even further away. We've got other techniques for those.
That's right, yeah. There's a whole ladder of techniques we use. You know, for things that are very nearby now, planets, we can bounce radar off of them and get quite accurate measurements. But of course, you can't bounce radar off the nearest stars, so you can use parallax. Part of this story that I think is incredible is that although we've been at this for a long time, you know, people have been wondering about how far away the stars were forever. Thales, you know, supposedly fell into a well looking up at the stars. We're making remarkable progress very recently. There's kind of a revolution happening in astronomy. Some new technology and some new projects that are space-based satellites and so on are actually vastly expanding our ability to do these things and to make these kinds of measurements. We forget, again, in the 1920s, we were arguing about whether or not there were any other galaxies besides our own. And now we can take photographs and see that there may be tens of trillions of other galaxies, and we have photographs of them. So it's just an incredible renaissance, really, of discovery. But yet, you asked how do we make estimates to more distant things? We have a whole series of different of methods. One of the next ones is called main sequence fitting, and we realized quite unexpectedly that the color of stars is related to how luminous they are, the amount of light they give off. So it turns out that red stars, for example, tend to be less luminous. They give off less light than blue stars, which are much more luminous. I'm using the word luminous instead of brightness because we have to distinguish between how much light something is actually giving off and how bright it appears to be when we look at it. Stars can be they can give off an enormous amount of light, but be so far away that they appear dim to us. Or they can be not terribly bright, but be so close that they look very bright to us. But if you know how luminous a star actually is, if you know that it gives off a certain amount of light, and you look at it and you see it to have a particular brightness, then you can infer from that how far away it must be, right? If you imagine a candle moving farther away from you, it's going to get less and less bright as it gets far away. And so you can work out how far away it has to be based on how much light you're receiving. Hertzsprung and Russell realized that stars of a certain color tend to have a certain luminosity. And what that means is we can look at stars that are much more distant, you know, far too far away for us to make a parallax observation. But we can look at their color and from that infer how luminous they are. And if we know how luminous they are, we can figure out what their distance must be because of their perceived brightness here on Earth. It's pretty incredible. So there's a whole, and that's just sort of the next rung. There are several rungs above that. We can keep moving up the ladder. That gets us, you know, to measurements of maybe stars in nearby galaxies, but not much farther. With parallax, it turns out, until at least very recently, we could only make measurements to about 100 light years, which that sounds big. But when you think, well, it's something like 30,000 light years just to the center of our own galaxy, and it's another 2.5 million light years to the next nearby galaxy, and that's only one galaxy amongst trillions. The universe is just unfathomably large.
Let me ask you, how did the students respond to this? I was there when the students were all figuring out the distance to the moon and so on. How do they respond to the course?
Oh, I think it's incredibly exciting. It's just a wonderful story. It's it does so much. It tells us how beautiful creation is, how magnificent it is. You know, I've been thinking over the last couple of weeks talking about this with the students, this notion that modern people sometimes have that we used to think that the universe was kind of this wonderful place, this enchanted cosmos, and there's this kind of narrative that now we don't think that anymore because we have math and science. That seems like just an absurd position to take once you understand what science is actually telling us about the universe. What we're discovering every day is that, no, the universe is just incredible. It's unbelievable. It's spectacular. It's really magnificent. We also see, I think this is really exciting for the students, that there's something surprising in all this, which is that the universe is intelligible. And that's a very Aristotelian thing to say. That's something that everyone likes to hear. It's easy to agree with that here. But what I mean is that it is neither too hard for us to understand nor too easy for us to understand. It seems to be intelligible and kind of proportioned to our ability to know. So that, you know, you can imagine being an ant in our universe and everything would be just so hard that you couldn't know anything. You know, you could never make any progress with an ant brain. But for us, we look out and we're able to keep discovering and to keep knowing. It's not too hard for us. I mean, it is hard, but we're able to make progress. So we see not only that the universe is ordered, but it also seems to be ordered in a way that is proportioned to our ability to know, which I think is pretty exciting. You know, we're knowers and that we're supposed to know and keep falling in love with creation. And it's hard not to do that when you see how magnificent it is.
The psalmist sang, "The heavens are declaring the glory of God, and the firmament proclaims his handiwork." And Job reminds us that God is the one who alone stretched out the heavens and trampled the waves of the sea, who made the Bear and Orion, the Pleiades, and the Chambers of the South. As if preparing for Dr. Olson's sophomore course, next week our freshmen will be spending an evening stargazing. And you won't find a much better place to see the heavens than here in Lander. That being the case, let me also mention that stargazing is a staple of the annual Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, June 9th to 14th this year. And while it doesn't directly flow from our topic, no greater gift, friendship from the Iliad to Facebook, the brightness and the glory of the heavens always add a sense of awe and humility to our gathering. Why not plan to join us this year? For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.